Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. The rumors are true. It is summer 2021. And when you think of summer, you know, here in the U.S., there are certain things that come to mind. One of those things is the traditional image of the enterprising kid opening the lemonade stand. Hi, I'm Ben. That's our super producer, Max Williams. And hey, I got to ask you, Noel, did you ever have a lemonade stand?
No, I didn't. But I mean, you know, I think the classic image that pops into one's head, it has to be made of very hastily assembled planks, you know, that are like nailed together very precariously and that could collapse at any moment. Of course, that certainly isn't the modern lemonade stand. It's probably more of like a card table situation, perhaps like a piece of paper taped to the front that says lemonade. You know, what's the inflation rate on lemonade? What does a glass of lemonade go for in modern times? Dollar? $2?
You know, it's interesting you ask because I'm sure the price has changed when kids are doing it over time. But I also imagine you can make quite a hefty profit from lemonade because the recipe is simple. It's lemons, water, and then sugar, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, I feel like people need a little more these days. You got your basil lemonades. You got your raspberry lemonades, you know, blueberry lemonade. I feel like kids these days got to take it a step further. Have you ever had basil lemonade, by the way? It's a weird one, but I dig it.
I've made basil lemonade. I went through a heavy lemonade phase a few years ago that lasted for about a year. And that's where I learned from an old dear friend, the secret of using agave nectar in place of sugar. It's super,
agreed,
super, super smooth. I myself had, when I was a kid, I did make a lemonade stand, but I had all kinds of hustles. And most of the people in my neighborhood who were buying our lemonade, because it was a group effort, most of those folks were like the folks who frequent lemonade stands. Whenever they see them, they just wanted to reward some kids for being go-getters. You know what I mean? So if I'm honest with you, I feel like a lot of people bought our lemonade and maybe didn't drink it. Our prices were competitive too, I'll admit.
I appreciate that. And that's the thing, you're right, Ben, about the idea of the classic American lemonade stand. It almost represents the entrepreneurial spirit of this country, you know, and it honestly has its roots in that, and especially specifically one of the most famous young enterprising lemonade lads was a young immigrant. And we will get to that in due time. But first of all, I want to ask Ben, do you know what a citron is? I only just recently kind of put together the image of what this fruit is and the name.
Yeah, it can be confusing because a citron is a kind of tree that bears fruit that look a lot like lemons, but they have some important differences. The two biggest differences are, if I recall correctly, that the citron is more fragrant and it's a little bit less acidic, I want to say. Is that correct?
I think that's right. It's definitely a burlier looking fruit, too. It's got all these kind of wrinkles and ripples on the skin, and the rind is a lot thicker and more hearty, let us say. But it is kind of the OG citrus fruit, and it's something that you would even see in like ancient Roman murals, right? And easy to confuse for lemons, because lemons probably originated in India or China or somewhere in that neck of the global woods, as you'd say, Ben. But you know, we do see images of lemons or lemon-like citrus fruits in some of these Roman murals as well. And it's an interesting thing because the lemon on its own It's kind of like, what do you do with it? It's so sour. I know some people enjoy probably sucking on a lemon, as Tom York would say. But in general, they work best when you pair them with other things, whether sure. it be a cocktail or using it to kind of like add a little acidity to a dish or adding a heck of a lot of sugar and making what has become known as lemonade.
Yeah, yeah. It's an ancient practice. We know relatively little about the origin other than things we can piece together, like the fact that the earliest proven human cultivation of the lemon tree was probably in medieval Arabia. So that's where, if we were saying lemonade, like actual lemonade instead of, you know, citronade or whatever, that's where this occurred. And, you know, I was searching for the phrase for this, Noel. It's Norman Rockwell-esque here in the U.S., the idea of the lemonade stand. I also want to give a shout out to some of the sources we're going to be using today, and a very special shout out to our two-part series on pink lemonade. All I can remember is the second one, The Rise of the Clown Pants.
Oh, yeah.
check that out.
Please do check it out. But just that's going to something along the lines of that story is going to come around in today's yes. story as well.
Yep. And we're doing this with the help of historyextra.com. We've got some great mental floss articles as well. One of these that stood out especially was Greg Jenner's Who Invented Lemonade. So we're going to be pulling from these and a few other fantastic sources. We may even run into a couple of recipes for lemonade. No promises. Yeah. We'll see where the day takes us.
Oh, and in a stunning sort of full circle type situation, I think we've got a couple of How Stuff Works articles on here as well.
We do.
From the good old days. And one of my favorites, too, is The Battle Against Lemonade Stand Crackdowns. Three Arrests on Lemonade Freedom Day by Alexander Abad Santos from The Atlantic. We'll just tease it with that title, and then we'll get to it in due time. But you're right, mm-hmm. Ben. I mean, the practice of making a sweetened citrus-based drink goes back to, I believe, ancient Egypt during the Crusades.
At the very least.
Mm-hmm. If not earlier.
Know, right. We know that's when a lot of Europeans may have encountered this. And, you know, people were trying to figure out what goes well with lemon for a long time. They had a couple things that we may look back on as missteps. Perhaps one of the best is, as Jenner mentions, in Tudor England, when lemon juice was used for a drink that we wouldn't recognize as lemonade today. It was called Water Imperial. It was a cordial. So it's, as you can tell, it's got lemon juice. It's got water. It's also got cream of tartar. And people drank this because they felt it had a curative effect.
What is cream of tartar supposed to do? I've seen that in the spice rack section or of the grocery store, but I've never quite fully understood what you're supposed to use it for.
It is usually the main use I know for it today is to stabilize whipped egg whites, and then it can also stop sugar from crystallizing. But
stiff peaks.
Mm-hmm. So, like, it's one of those things, honestly. You know, I cook a lot, we both cook pretty frequently. Cream of tartar is one of those things that I've just had and maybe used once a year or something. I'm never having we've got to get to the store before it closes. I'm almost totally. Out of cream of tartar moments.
Nothing to do with tartar sauce, I imagine. Completely separate things or no?
Funny enough, separate things. Tartar sauce doesn't have any cream of tartar. Mm-hmm. Instead, tartar sauce is named after the tartar family. And it's basically ginned up mayonnaise.
It's just mayonnaise with like pickle chunks in it. Like mayonnaise and relish mixed together is essentially what tartar mm-hmm. sauce is. And I like it. I don't really like those things separately, but I do like a good McDonald's fish filet sandwich. Excuse me, filet-o-fish sandwich every now and again.
So everybody has their own taste. And some people were... some people were honestly digging water imperials, but along the way, by the mid-1600s, various people in London and elsewhere had started using sweet lemon juice mixed with honey and water as a beverage. And they didn't necessarily make it on their home soil. They imported it from France. And by, you know, 1600s France, there was this huge, I guess we would call them pop-up stores, roaming lemonaders.
Right. Or lemonadiers. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I wish Casey Pegram was here to help us out with that. But yeah, lemonaders would probably be the Americanized pronunciation, and lemonadiers, because it's spelled L-I-M-O-N-A-D-I-E-R-S. Sounds like a little more of the Francophone pronunciation. There's a really great Mental Floss article called The Surprisingly Disgusting History of Lemonade Stands, which is a good tease. And if you've heard the Pink Lemonade episode, I think you know what we're inching towards. But you're right. It was even taken a step further, right? Because, I mean, France is where the whole cabaret scene kind of really started to take off. And, you know, the Moulin Rouge and all of that stuff with burlesque dancers and just all of this kind of showmanship. And you would see boozy versions of these sold in some of these cabaret theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A light, refreshing drink that also gives you a light, arguably refreshing buzz. And they did sell more than just this like predecessor of Mike's Hard Lemonade, but they got known for this because it was a popular like novelty drink. And it became so popular that eventually everybody who sold it was able to get together and start a union called, the name would translate to the Company of Lemonadiers. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from Carrie Totrow in our own House of Works article, Fascinating History of Lemonade.
Yeah, and there's another mention in that article about, I believe, something we've also done an episode on, how it might have been part of a list, I can't remember, but a list episode, but it was the idea that Parisians, at least they believed, helped fend off the plague because of all of the lemons that they were consuming in this lemonade, because it was like a dose of vitamin C that supposedly gave you a immuno boost, kind of, you know, which is still definitely a thing that we know vitamin C to do. It turns out that it was more the fact that lemon peels have a substance in it that can kill flea larvae. And also adult fleas. So the more lemonade people drank, the more of these discarded lemon peels were around, the more the rats ate the lemon peels, and they ingested this chemical called limonene that killed the fleas and their eggs. So it wasn't that it was giving them some kind of magical immuno boost, even though it does a little bit, certainly not enough to fend off the bubonic plague. It was more that it was killing the source of the plague, which was those fleas.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the idea of citrus fruit as curative, in any case, it's a long-held belief in this part of the world, even though it wasn't until, about 1753 or so, when James Lind from the Royal Navy figured out that you could treat scurvy with citrus. The point is, they were on to something.
Yes. They didn't know quite what it was yet.
Right, exactly. And so then we have things like, you know, fast forward a little while, we have the addition of fizziness in 1767. And then that goes all the way back to Schweppes, if you remember, the fizzy drink that's still around today. Schweppes started in 1790. Eventually, we get to what we would call the era of lemonade stands. By the 1830s, fizzy lemonade from Schweppes was pretty available around Europe. And so you wouldn't see as many European lemonade stands. But if we go to the 1700s, we see that lemonade has made its way across the Atlantic to what we recognize as the United States today.
Yeah, throughout the 1800s, we started to see more references, if a little bit few and far between, in you know, news reporting, right? For example, the New York Times has mention of a lemonade stand at a, quote, ladies' fair that took place in October of 1839, pulling some of these stats and details from that Mental Floss article once again, including one mentioning 1853, when a woman supposedly was operating a lemonade stand in Cincinnati. And hey, this is also kind of like a very close connection to our episode on mashers and wolf whistles, right? This woman running this stand in Cincinnati really stuck it to these two men that were kind of catcalling her. And she actually tore one of their coattails off. She has referred to them as a rowdy, which is definitely seems like a progenitor of the masher. Then we have one in 1873 at Cornell University, where a young student was using a lemonade stand to help pay college tuition in the student hall by setting up his own independently operated lemonade stand in the student hall.
Yeah, and fellow ridiculous historians, you'll notice something interesting with those two examples. It's part of a larger pattern. While we associate lemonade stands largely with children today, When it first came into vogue in the U.S., it was very much an adult business, and it was a serious one, and had the support at times of teetotalers, people who abstain from alcohol and don't want anyone else drinking booze, and they would say lemonade is a great alternative to a cold beer. And ever since the New York Times first referenced lemonade being sold in Wisconsin in 1879, we saw lemonade stands popping up like everywhere around New York City. Starbucks had nothing on them. They would sell cups of lemonade for a nickel each. And eventually, as heat waves came on, people found that these lemonade stands were starting to outsell bars and soda fountains, because they had almost zero overhead. You know, they didn't have to pay property taxes, they didn't have to pay building fees or, you know, upkeep or maintenance for a building. And they were able to pass those savings on, as the old business saying goes, to the consumer. So if you went to a store, you went to a bar or whatever, and you said, hey, I'm going to have a glass of lemonade, it might be as much as 15 cents. But if you went outside and just found somebody with a lemonade stand, then they would have it for 5 cents. No updates yet on whether or not you got to keep the cup. That probably varied place to place.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's something that probably would come a little later in terms of like really upping their game with like a commemorative cup that you could take with you. But this whole idea of selling low overhead refreshments is certainly something as American as apple pie or lemonade. We have an example of this kind of disgusting history of lemonade. If you'll recall, in the Pink Lemonade episode, there were a couple of competing theories as to where the Pink Lemonade came from. And one of them involved, I believe it was a circus where the lemonade seller ran out of fresh water and so instead used the water that the clowns and acrobats were using to rinse their tights. And because the clowns had red tights or pants that dye colored the water pink. And then obviously the sugar and the lemons were added in, which probably cuts the putridness of that clown pants water, but still can't imagine it tasted particularly refreshing. So we have a similar case of this. I can't quite remember what year that story took place, but this one was in the 1860s in New York, when, of course, immigrants were making their way to this country through Ellis Island on New York. And people were looking to make a buck off of these weary travelers, right?
Yeah. So instead of buying, you know, fresh lemons, a good quantity of sugar, and then mixing it, you know, with clean potable water, instead, these unscrupulous folks would fill up whatever dirty container they had with water, molasses, and vinegar. And then to make it appear like it was a little bit closer to lemonade, they would take sliced leftover lemon rinds and sprinkle them across the top. So for some, this is interesting because it means that for some early immigrants to the country, the the literally the first thing they tried in their new homeland would have been this terrible vinegar sugar water. But luckily that's just one bad example, and there are plenty of other very scrupulous lemonade dealers. If you ever sold lemonade as a kid, which, you know, now is kind of a cutesy, relatively archaic thing, I could argue, you might be interested to know that you owe a lot of your inspiration to a kid named Edward Bok, B-O-K. He is the first American child that we know of so far to have sold lemonade. And he also was an immigrant. He came over from the Netherlands, right?
Yeah, that's right. Bok in particular, when he was hanging out near his home in Brooklyn, he would go towards Coney Island, which has changed some, but there's still some lovely, charming qualities of Coney Island that are probably very much the same as they were in Bok's day. And he noticed that some of the wealthier, you know, folks were riding around in these horse-drawn carriages, and that the men would make the children and the women wait in the hot summer sun, you know, inside these carriages, while they would go inside to get a cocktail or a highball or whatever at the cigar shop. And he thought this was odd. He found this a little unusual and was like, you know what? I bet you they're thirsty. And so he looked at this as an in to make a little cash. So he got himself a pail, a bucket, not a filthy one, like the folks that were targeting, you know, people like Bok at Ellis Island at the port. And he attached three like hooks to the side and three glasses. And he would fill the bucket up. And when the horses stopped and the men went out, he would offer the women and children glasses of cold ice water for 1 cent a glass. So what are we talking here, Ben? This is in the 1870s. What is a penny in 1870s dollars amount to today? That should help us determine the inflation for what maybe a good price for a glass of lemonade would be today. Can I get a boop?
You know, actually, let's put a slight pause on inflation calculator. It will rework some of the metrics, if that's all right with everybody. We know that he made 30 cents total, right? For every pail.
Per
he
pail.
Emptied.
That's yeah. Right.
So he went through a lot of pails. 30 cents in 1870. Now let's run it. It is,
and a boop.
It is worth about $6.16 today. That's okay. A lot of inflation, but he's like, you know, he could make a pretty hefty amount of cash, especially for a kid.
I know it's a little bit of a bummer that we don't quite know how many, what size these glasses were and what size the bucket was. That would probably help us with a little bit more inflation math. But I think that gets us about where we need to be. You can imagine if he was working his butt off, he could probably go through quite a few pails in a day, right?
Sure, especially on like a Saturday when it's hot out. He, you know, he had his head in the game. He's a smart kid, but he had a lot of people following his lead, and soon he was not the only water boy at the spot. And so as these competitors started eating into his turf and his profits, he decided he was going to do something a little different. And he began selling a version of lemonade, just squeezing lemon juice into the water, adding sugar to make it palatable. And then he would sell this for 3 cents a glass.
Ooh, now we're talking. So now we're talking like 90 cents for every pail. Of this delicious beverage. Where do you think he got the idea, Ben? Do you think he was like getting inspiration from somewhere? Surely he wasn't aware of the ancient Egyptians or the lemonade craze in France. A kid of his age? I wonder where he got the idea.
He probably saw it around.
Yeah,
he probably saw
true.
That other
that's
people
true.
Were doing it, and they just weren't doing it at the spot that he thought would be a great place to sell it. So again, very smart kid. Also becomes a celebrity of sorts in the U.S. at the time. He even gets to do a little bit of work with Ladies' Home Journal. And then later there's a biography published of him in 1921 called The Americanization of Edward Bok.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he even himself wrote a book that won a Pulitzer Prize. Again, fantastic article on mental floss by Jake Rawson. Surprisingly disgusting history of lemonade stands. Highly recommend reading the whole thing. But this story, right, it really struck a chord in the zeitgeist of the time, right? And it really became, that's sort of when I think the public consciousness maybe shifted more from these, you know, unscrupulous adults trying to put one over on people, or, you know, there were obviously were proper lemonadiers and all that, but it became much more of like a thing associated with youngsters that were like trying to hustle and you know, lift themselves up by their bootstraps. But it really did kind of inject itself into popular culture by the 1930s, right?
Yeah. It really began to be a part of the American zeitgeist. And now we enter a part of the story that reminds me of that scene with the banker from Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm. The father's like, penny and compound interest and all that stuff.
Yes.
Because these lemonade stands, having one, began to be seen as this sort of wholesome lesson in the power of capitalism and free enterprise. So if your kid wanted, you know, like a penny farthing, I'm making up, but if your kid wanted something, whatever their version of the Elmo or the hottest Christmas toy was, then what you would do as a parent is take that as a learning opportunity, a quote unquote teachable moment. And you would say, well, with just a little bit of investment, I may not help you buy, you know, this hoop and stick that you want, but I will help pay for some lemons and get some sugar from, you know, the kitchen, and you can learn how business works. And so it's kind of a cool experience, right? It's experiential learning. If you're a kid, you learn the importance of accounting, profits and loss, and then you also learn the importance of location. God, there's a whole, now I think about it, you learn a ton of stuff. You also learn the importance of word of mouth, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, you're right, Ben, all of that stuff I think would probably also be considered sort of, at the very least, part of the American zeitgeist, but also kind of the impetus that led to its inclusion in a lot of pop culture tropes, right, that we know and love. One of the earliest examples would be in the Marx Brothers film Duck Soup that came out in 1933. And another great source that we used for this is an NPR piece called America's Attack on Lemonade Stands by Linton Weeks. And in this film, Duck Soup from 1933, you've got Harpo Marx, who kind of gets into a beef. He's a peanut salesman. He's got a cart. And next to him is Edgar Kennedy, who is selling lemonade, this lemonade stand. And, hilarity ensues when Kennedy starts to harass Harpo. And by the way, Harpo was the Marx brother that didn't speak. But he would do all kinds of physical sight gags. And this one, he rolls his pant legs up and sticks his bare feet into Kennedy's lemonade dispenser. This really makes me think of the Pink Lemonade clown pants story. Mm-hmm. But then you start getting, you know, again, these are adults. Admittedly, they're like man children. But a few years later, you've got the Little Rascals gang, our gang, in an episode called The Lucky Corner.
Yep. That is a short film in which the Our Gang kids, the Little Rascals, set up a lemonade stand. Competition takes over. They start cutting corners. Lemonade gets spewed all over the place. And eventually, you know, hilarity with a heavy emphasis on physical comedy ensues. There are more and more and more cases of lemonade stands popping up in fiction and in art. There is a lemonade stand in a famous Norman Rockwell illustration from 1955. Anybody remembers the Andy Griffith Show?
Oh, yeah.
Which they, you know, that, you know, of course, Opie had his own lemonade stand in the 1960s, and he was selling his lemonade. See, this is where they Hollywoodized it. He was selling his lemonade for just 2 cents. And this kid in New York, decades and decades and decades and decades ago, is selling it for, you know, 5 cents. I feel like they maybe glossed over the economics of
it. Well, this is in Mayberry dollars, so I think that the inflation rate is different, or the exchange rate. Yeah, Mayberry is sort of a magical place where lemonade only costs you 2 cents a glass.
Ooh, can we get a lightning storm? A little ominous thunder on the horizon.
Sure, sure.
Story's taking a turn.
It is about to take a pretty dark turn. We're into the 40s now, and boy, oh boy, we talked about how lemonade helped cure the plague or helped eliminate the vermin infestation that caused the plague or that carried the plague, these rats that carried the flea larva that led to more fleas that spread that horrible disease. In the 40s, we have another, I think you could call it a plague, at the very least a pandemic, in the form of polio, an incredibly communicable disease that affected children at an alarming rate.
Yeah, so as more people are creating lemonade stands and as the sale of lemon and lemon products becomes more commercialized, more mass-produced, you're going to see some kids starting to use frozen lemon juice concentrate or lemonade concentrate or even store-bought lemonade they're selling for a markup. And then adding sweetener, bottled water. They're experimenting with other flavors like we talked about with agave or like we talked about with basil, blueberry, and so on. Because you can add any number of flavors to lemonade. But in a suburb of Chicago in the summer of 1941, a young woman who was not named in this story apparently started selling lemonade, as you would, in a little makeshift stand just outside of her house. And after a period of weeks, the health department of the local county came a calling because it turned out that she had been having people reuse their glasses. She had been rinsing them after the customers returned it to her.
Sure.
And then that gave her polio. And that was just the beginning of the problem.
Jeez, yeah, a bunch of her friends got it too. I mean, again, this is like very, very contagious. You can get it from just, you know, sharing a glass with somebody. And I think this pointed out too, I'm sure that others were doing this. You know, I mean, the original story we have about the young boy from the Netherlands, he only had 3 glasses total. So, I mean, and if he was selling the water, I don't think he had anything to rinse it with. So, I mean, the origins of these lemonade stands is in and of itself kind of unsanitary. So this really just pointed that out in a big way. And there then led to this crackdown on lemonade stands, unsanctioned lemonade stands, unlicensed, I guess, selling of lemonade, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this investigation finds that 4 of her friends around her age had also contracted polio. And then additionally, they found 7 people were asymptomatic carriers, meaning they had it, but they didn't show signs of having it. And this, Noel, this is what really let people know just how easily this virus could spread and how long you could carry it before showing any signs. Luckily, there is a character who comes into play to save the day. By 1954, the one and only Jonas Salk, his vaccine for polio was about to become widely available.
Wow, that's 10 years before a vaccine. We should really thank our lucky stars, shouldn't we? That we have giant pharmaceutical conglomerates working on our behalf for surely no monetary gain, right? Right, Ben?
Yeah, no comment there. So this is strange because, you know, the world comes together, the U.S. comes together at least, to endorse fundraisers to cover treatment for polio. The March of Dimes begins, and now people start selling lemonade to support the fight against polio. It's very strange bedfellows history makes.
Yeah, it really, really is. But, you know, at the same time, this is really, really interesting, that image endures, right? Of like the entrepreneurial spirit of the United States and like, you know, the fact that this story about Edward Bach, which surely the way it was elevated and lifted up, you know, there was some slightly, I would say, propagandistic, you know, intent behind that. Like, this young immigrant lifted himself up by his bootstraps, you know, selling lemonade. And so it was absolutely like part of the identity of the United States as this like melting pot, this land of opportunity, which, as we know, oftentimes that is just an image, you know? I mean, it certainly is a land of opportunity for certain folks, but not for everybody. And a lot of times getting ahead in that way requires some aggressive tactics, more so than just being a clever lad selling lemonade on the street.
Yeah, and I want to give a special anti-shout out to the people who are, they're doing the right thing, but they still feel a little bit like Disney villains to me. The folks who have slapped kids with lemonade stands with fines because they need to comply with health and safety regulations, or they haven't gotten a permit according to local law. In fact, right now, as we record, it is illegal to have a lemonade stand without a permit in 36 states in the nation.
Wow.
Yeah, this even led to protests, something a lot of folks may have never heard of, Lemonade Freedom Day.
Lemonade Freedom Day. And also, I think everyone knows probably the most popular canned and powdered, and I think even there's a version of it that comes out of a soda fountain, lemonade that's available today is from Country Time, which probably is owned by Coca-Cola now. I'm not quite sure, but there was a time where it was probably a very folksy, small company that got in the game early. But they have, in 2018, pledged $60,000 in grants to help some of these kids, these oppressed kids, pay these fines related to their lemonade stand. But I mean, I don't know, in the times of COVID, might be a slight different direction in PR for this one.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And, you know, fun fact, I just checked on air, Country Time, my friend, is owned by Kraft Foods.
There you go.
I didn't see that one coming, but I guess it makes sense. And before we head out today, first, thank you for tuning in to the strange history of lemonade stands. We wanted to add something special to today's show. And Noel, we have a special guest today, don't we? Someone, it's not the Quister, because we're both very happy to hear from this person.
We sure are. We are going to hear from an actual human child who is cringing so hard right now. Can you hear the cringe? That's the sound of her teeth literally gritting together. She's just shaking her head up and down. I can't tell if that's a yes or a no. ladies and gentlemen, Eden Brown, my child.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Eden.
Hi.
We have to ask you a couple of quick questions here. This is very important.
Okay.
We need the inside scoop from what the kids are saying these days. How do you feel about the idea of the lemonade stand as it relates to American entrepreneurship?
I'm scared of lemonade stands.
Why? Because of polio?
No, because the children are gross.
Well, then, okay.
Yeah, that's good. So it's less about the lemonade itself, Eden, and more about the purveyors of it, huh? The kids creep you out?
They probably, I feel like they're like sticking their fingers in the lemonade.
Why do you think that? Do you just think kids are just, this is something you do?
No.
Well, why do you have such a negative opinion of your fellow kids?
Because they're gross.
Well, okay, but I need more. I need more.
I am a sanitary child, unlike my fellow children.
Okay, so you're a bit of a neat freak. You're a bit of a germaphobe, we could say. Okay.
Yeah. That's understandable.
It is, especially coming through what we've been through, right, in the last year. Literally living through a situation where you're like, hey, if you don't wash your hands, you might die.
And you know what's funny, Eden, is I totally see your point. It's funny to me is if you saw a lemonade stand where someone had a special announcement where they said, you know, Max's lemonade stand, 100% guaranteed, we don't put our fingers in it. That would just make me more uncomfortable. What about you?
Yeah, that sounds, I wouldn't trust it.
Wait a minute. Are you saying you don't trust advertisement? You need to confirm but verify, perhaps?
Yeah.
Okay.
Most advertisements just don't. Like food advertisements, I don't know. They just gross me out.
So how do you feel about, in general, like food products? Do you feel like they're mainly safe if they say they're safe, or do you not even trust like the FDA? How far does this go, Eden? How far does this go?
I mean, I don't trust. I don't know. I don't trust like fast food restaurants or things that are made by children.
So it's exclusively a distrust of children. I gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I get it. You know, for instance, I would like, it's weird if it's, you know, your friend's children or if it's people that you're friends with and they say, hey, a kid made some cookies or something, then you feel kind of obligated to take it. But like, I don't think anybody would drive a car or ride in a car that was made by, you know, a six-year-old, right?
Yes, yes. All right. Well, Eden, do you have anything to add?
I said it already, but lemonade stands are scary and don't trust them.
Duly noted. Words from the mouths of babes. From
words
the mouths
from
of
the,
babes.
The expert as well. And big, big special thanks to the one and only Eden Brown. Thanks to Max Williams and Casey Pegram. And thanks, of course, to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Lemonade Bandit, a.k.a. Yep. the Quizster.
Yep, you've been replaced by a child.
Let's start giving him nicknames and never explain them to him. Because do you think he listens to the episodes?
I don't know. He's in the group sometimes, the Facebook group, The Ridiculous Historians, which we often forget to mention to people. By the way, Ben, I want to point out that this email address that we supposedly have,
right.
What is it again?
It should be ridiculous at iHeartMedia, but we've been getting mixed reports about it.
We've been getting mixed. I got a mixed report today from a lovely listener that reached out on Instagram and said they had a bounce back, but it looked like they were sending it to iHeartRadio. So make sure you send those to ridiculous@iHeartMedia.com. And if you're still having problems, let us know. But you can also reach us elsewhere on the internet, can't you?
Yes, absolutely. You can find us, as we said, on our Facebook page, Ridiculous Historians. You can also give us a shout on Instagram. As always, we can't wait to hear from you and stay tuned for our next episode, which we are tentatively titling The Underground Duke.
See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.